Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back to Overnight America. I'm your host, Ryan Recker, and you can always get this show digitally, wherever you have your smartphone in your pocket or your hand. Just a couple of clicks on your favorite podcast app. Search for Overnight America. It's right there, and we do it all for free. And that's a service we put together because we love you, Mr. Rogers style. Earlier today, Nick Sandman's lawyers filed the lawsuit. There was some potential letters going out to a lot of different news and, I guess, different personalities that covered the Covington story pretty poorly. I mean, very poorly. And the first of the lawsuits have been filed. This time it is the Washington Post, $250 million lawsuit. Altogether, I think it's actually a $200 million lawsuit and then a $50 million lawsuit. But to try to break this down, we're going to join our great friend Brad Young from Harris Dowell Fisher & Young. Hey, Brad.
Hey, good evening, Mr. Recker. You know, hey, and by the way, before we get into this, I got to tell you, I think Mike Anderson's onto something, that the key to keeping the Blues winning is a well-hydrated Kevin Killeen.
I know.
I think it's spot on.
That's what we need. In fact, I don't want to try to rock that boat. I don't want to try to get him where he's thirsty. We just got to keep pumping him full of liquids because it seems to be working right now.
That's right. Hey, listen, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I read this letter that the lawyers of Nick Sandman sent out. It was a long one, and I highlighted some parts I wanted to talk to you about, because $250 million is a lot of money that they're asking. It's funny because at the end, they say, well, here's how they came to the conclusion of the 250. They said, that's essentially what they bought the newspaper for, Jeff Bezos of Amazon fame. So they figure it's worth that. That's how much the lawsuit should be worth, how much they were purchased for. That doesn't seem typical. I don't know.
No, that's very atypical, I can assure you.
Yeah. So you read this letter that the lawyers put out. And
well, actually, I read the pleading, all 38 pages of the actual lawsuit itself.
Oh, so you went through the actual legal documents. I just read the summary. There's some links that were posted in a couple of the articles. And it sets their stage. They talk about the Post. They talk about how they were credited with inventing the term McCarthyism. So how ironic is it that they did this to these Covington kids? What's your overall impressions of this?
Well, putting it in the context of libel law, I mean, that requires context, because, first of all, there's no question that what the Post did, and really all the mainstream media, it's per se journalistic malpractice. Mm-hmm. I mean, they ran with the story. That it was very apparent very quickly that the information getting put out by Nathan Phillips was false, it was wrong, and it was incorrect, and yet they continue to run with the story. So There's no question it's journalistic malpractice. Now, having said that, the question is, does that rise to the level of libel or more likely defamation? That's the part where it starts to break down, because there are specific legal standards for proving defamation, and if it's a statement of an opinion, then it simply cannot be the basis of defamation. And that's what a lot of this is statements of opinion.
There's a couple of things they mentioned in there that I thought were fascinating. They mentioned that he was bullied. So they used the term bullied a lot. And they also said it was because he was white, Catholic, and wearing a red Make America Great Again souvenir cap. So the fact that his race and his religion factor into it, does that change anything if that's how they're arguing this?
No, because again, that's a statement of opinion, and when I make these statements that it may not rise to the level of libel, although I do think that there is a possibility of prevailing here, certainly because of where the venue that this has been filed in, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. But specifically, everything that you just said, Ryan, those were all statements of opinion, that he was being harassed because he's white, He was wearing a MAGA hat, and he was religious. Those things are statements of opinion because you don't know really why the kid was being harassed. So that's a great example of the difference between a statement of fact and a statement of opinion, and that's a statement of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on with you recently talking about this. I did some legal research then, and there are lots of federal cases that hold that calling just someone an outright racist is simply a statement of an opinion, and lawsuits have been dismissed on that basis alone.
Mm. They also mention, and I'm just going to read some of the parts that I thought were fascinating. So they talked about how there were instances where, and then they go through and they say, here's the first article, second article, third, fourth, fifth, and they break down some of the things that were untrue in those articles. But one of the prevailing things they said was, they said these things despite there being evidence to the contrary. So they were reporting these things. They were putting in quotes from other people. They were saying these other things too. And they were coming to these assertions in their articles and even in their headlines, the way they were writing their headlines, despite there being evidence to the contrary that they didn't report to. Could that get them in trouble?
Yes. And that's where this comes into play. And I think the strongest legal argument that the Covington boys have is the fact that not the initial reporting, because the Post and others were initially interviewing Nathan Phillips. He was the one making the statements, and they were reporting that.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't see any cause of action for that. Mm-hmm. However, once the YouTube videos started to be posted showing, and this happened very quickly, showing the entire context of the event was far different than what Mr. Phillips, an admitted liar when he said that he served in Vietnam and he didn't, when those things started to be posted online, the continuation of those stories online and the continuation of the reporting absolutely can lead to a verdict in their favor. And that's really where venue comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Because we see this, we've all seen it in movies, and it's one of the few areas of movies that are actually accurate regarding the portrayal of the law. But where you file a lawsuit is so important.
Mm-hmm.
You got to remember, this lawsuit was filed in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kentucky is not a place that's known to be in love with the Washington Post or any of these other defendants. So you don't drive down and see billboards that say, Washington Post, we love you. You know, you don't see that in Kentucky. You don't see that.
I know.
So you're going to have a jury here that's predisposed. When the jury pool gets picked, there could be people on the jury pool wearing MAGA hats, okay?
Mm.
So you're going to have a jury that's going to be predisposed to rule in favor of their own boys that were beaten up, as opposed to standing up for some lofty First Amendment rights that the Washington Post is going to argue.
Yeah.
So I see the potential for a huge verdict. The question is, can that withstand judicial and appellate scrutiny? That's where the ifs come in.
You know, and something else they mentioned, and joining us is Brad Young from Harris, Dowell, Fisher & Young, friend of Overnight America. They said, the Post published with actual malice, it says the failure to investigate is highlighted where, as here, the January 18th incident was not breaking news and involved a minor child. So being that it wasn't breaking news, actually, it probably wasn't even news at all, and it involved minors, does that play a factor, too, that could work in their favor?
It does. And the reason why those elements play into the favor of the Covington boys is as follows. There's a different standard of libel and defamation when you compare a celebrity or a public figure to a private individual. There's no question these kids were private individuals. They weren't celebrities. They didn't have their own TV shows. You know, they were really private citizens. And that's why the lawsuit emphasizes that they're minors to demonstrate that, yes, they are private citizens, which lowers the standard that needs to be proved in order to win a defamation case.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why that's there. Also, you mentioned about that the Post knew that this information was wrong and they continued to report it. That goes to prove damages.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going to prove damages in a situation, the plaintiff has to show that the defendants knew their statements were false or likely to be false, yet continued to report that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where all of that, this lawsuit is 38 pages long, and there's lots of facts and details in this lawsuit to demonstrate that the Post knew or should have known this information was false, and yet they continue to report it. That's how you prove actual malice, which is necessary to get these big jury verdicts like $250 million.
Yeah, so right now the lawyers for Nicholas Sandman, they have enough to put all of this together, and the Washington Post is their first target. And since it's in Kentucky, something like this isn't going to get thrown out. Do you anticipate something like this actually moving forward or not being dismissed immediately?
Yeah, I see this getting to a jury.
Yeah,
I really do. I see it getting to a jury, and as I mentioned before, because of the venue that we're talking about in Kentucky, mm-hmm. I would even anticipate a big jury verdict. But it's just like we've seen with these enormous jury verdicts against Johnson & Johnson for the talcum powder issue mm-hmm. that's big right now in the Midwest. There's huge multi-billion-dollar verdicts, and yet they over and over get reversed on appeal. That's a big possibility here because of that whole issue of a statement of opinion mm-hmm. cannot be the basis for a defamation lawsuit. So that's really what the appellate courts will eventually be looking at.
If you're an organization like the New York Times or CNN, that's like number two or three on the list right after they put that the people that they were sending these warning letters to, I'd be sweating if I were them right now thinking like, oh boy, what? Something like this doesn't go in the Washington Post's favor. We're next. They got to be a little bit concerned.
Sure they do. And, you know, so many lawsuits, Ryan, get settled because they don't want to go to court on these.
Mm-hmm.
This is not one of those that gets settled.
Yeah.
Because the Washington Post or CNN or any of the mainstream media, they do not want to set a precedent that if you sue us for defamation, we'll pay you money.
Mm-hmm.
And so these cases are going to trial.
Ooh. So what happens next here?
Well, what happens next is that there'll be a lot of arguing over venue. In other words, what the Washington Post is going to want to do is to get this out of state court and try to get it into federal court. That's generally a more favorable court system for defendants in federal court because it slows everything down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the defendants want. They want to slow this down. So I would see a lot of posturing to get this, what's called, removed to federal court.
Mm-hmm.
I would anticipate that would most likely happen. Once all that happens, then you're going to have lots of discovery, lots of depositions, lots of expensive lawyers sending in expensive bills, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And at least
from your perspective, sure.
My perspective, you know, hey, lawyers, you know, they got to eat, man. The lawyers got to eat. So you can't dismiss that. But my point here is this is going to be a long process, and I think we're going to be seeing updates on this 1 or 2 years from now.
You know, what could also be an interesting wrinkle to this, since these kids are in high school, with this being drawn out, I'm sure they could lose out on some opportunities, which could be maybe presented in this case as damages, perhaps. Like, let's say as they start to get older, you know, they get refused jobs or scholarships or, you know, something happens in their life that's associated with this lawsuit that the lawyers can say, See, we're telling you, they've been persecuted because of this. They are responsible for them losing out on whatever it may be based on their age. I can see that and more things even popping up based on their age.
Absolutely. That's all going to go to show damages. And depending on what standards are applied here, then they're either going to be forced to show what's called actual damages, meaning, you know, I had to pay $1,000 for a security guard. I got kicked out of college, and that cost me $20,000. Those would be actual damages, as opposed to what's called, you know, more speculative damages, like this hurt my reputation. How do you put a value on that? So that's what we're going to be fighting, seeing that the attorneys fighting about as this proceeds.
Yep. Brad Young, I'm so glad you called in. Midnight, you were just waiting around and reading some court documents in your leisure. So I'm glad that you are nerdy like that in the legal world.
Yep, that and a P1 listener. So happy to help.
Awesome, Brad. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
That's Brad Young from Harris, Dow, Fisher & Young, friend of Overnight America. So what do you think? Nicholas Sandman and his colleagues, which is essentially his classmates, the people there at the March for Life, when the national media jumped on them unfairly reporting and saying things like, well, they were racist, they were bigoted, they were yelling things, they were being forceful, they were being aggressive, they were, surrounding, they were taunting, they were doing all these things. All of these things have been proven to be not true based on a lot of evidence. Now the first lawsuit is coming up. What do you think about it? 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120. Do you hope they win or do you hope they lose? It's Overnight America, KMOX. Really weird dynamic on CBS right now. Monitoring their late night programming, James Corden's interviewing Elizabeth Warren in 50 Cent. Wow, what a weird dynamic between the two of them. Why? How does that mix together? I don't know. Elizabeth Warren running for president. Oh, you see who else announced that they're running for president in 2020? Oh, I think you know deep down inside.
Bernie Sanders is running, yeah, that's right. Personally, I think he missed his time. But I like Bernie because he is one person that, you know, on trade, he sort of would agree on trade. I'm being very tough on trade. He would tough on trade. The problem is he doesn't know what to do about it.
Bernie's running for 2020. I do a pretty good Bernie Sanders impersonation, don't I? Nah, kind of. What do you want me to say as Bernie Sanders? I'll see if I can. Maybe I'll read this article as Bernie Sanders. Can we try that? What's that look you're giving me, producer Mike? Oh, this is a good one. This is from CNET, and it's making the case of why you should go to the movies alone. Why is there such a taboo on going to the movies by yourself? Ever since I was in high school or you get your driver's license, they say, oh, you can't go. You got to go with friends or you got to take a date. You can't just go to the movie theater alone. That's weird. Only weirdos do that. You know, Pee Wee Herman types do that. No, I've always enjoyed going to the movie alone if I had the opportunity. Here, let me try to read this as Bernie Sanders. I'm talking about going to the cinema during the day alone. That's more Jerry Seinfeld. Said, just try it. It'll change your life for the better. Right now, you might think differently. You might think, as I did once before, I'm going to the cinema by yourself is an activity for an elderly gentleman in flat caps and body warmers. Retired ladies of leisure armed with precisely made triangle sandwiches and warm flasks of peppermint tea. But you've never been more wrong. Wrong. If you're not already doing it, you're denying yourself one of life's secret pleasures. Is it okay to go to the movie theater alone? I think it is. I have no problem with it. In fact, I don't really go to the movies all that often, but every once in a while, there'll be something out there I'll really want to see. And I'm just fine with waiting until it comes out on video and renting it from the library. Like, there's a movie out right now. I want to see that Stan and Ollie, is it called, or something? It's the Oliver and Hardy movie that just came out. And I thought maybe I'll go see that by myself, but not going to. Oh, you give me that, calling me a big loser? No, I'm not. I just don't have any, I don't have any friends. Yeah, that's true. I just don't have any shame when it comes to that sort of thing. I don't feel shame for going and seeing a movie by myself. Some people feel shameful for doing that. Said, for years, you may have believed that the cinema day trip was in the realm of being a weirdo. He says, I understand this. In my mid-teens, back in the mid-90s, when I started going to the cinema by myself, I was a spotty-faced, trouble kid who bore the weight of this mentality. He said, I felt weird. And the world made it weird. My friends gave me grief. Even my parents thought it was strange, but despite how awkward it made me feel, it was always one of those something's wrong and you shouldn't go and you shouldn't do this feeling in the background. But why not? Said, the cinema day trips feels like skipping school. It's like smoking in the boys' room. Yeah, you're really cool if you go to the movies during the day. When I was a teenager, he says, I went to the cinema to hide from exams, pressures, zit on my forehead. As a 37-year-old man, we're about the same age. 37-year-old man, it was more of a release valve. Don't have to worry about all these other things going on. You'll do anything to escape children once you have young ones. Like, you'll take any opportunity you can to get a break from them, right? Like, you want to be able to just have that alone time. That's why when the parents get to go out on date night and they got the babysitter, it's like the greatest thing ever. But still, they worry about the kid, but it's still the greatest thing ever. For anyone else, like if my wife goes, she'll go to the neighbor with the neighbor to movies and things like that. They'll enjoy. She's got actual friends. Like, my wife has all kinds of friends. She's got hundreds, not hundreds, but she's got friends all over the place. People calling him up, people coming over to the house, you know, doing this, going on play dates, going over to their house. She's like super social. She comes to St. Louis. You know, when we lived in Indiana, she didn't have any friends. We moved to St. Louis. She makes a ton of friends. Everyone's super friendly to her. I come here. I just don't care to make friends. You know, I just like, I'm fine being alone. I'm one of those guys that they can put on an island for a year and isolate, and I'd be okay with that. Like, it wouldn't really, it would be hard to be separated from my family, but I would survive. I don't feel the need to be social with, you know, I get that here on Overnight America. Like, I get to talk to you. I get to interact with you. That's all I need in life. That's all I need. Coming up next hour, or actually in the next 5 minutes, we're going to replay an interview from the KMOX archives. This is awesome. Today is a date in history. One of the most iconic television programs in the history of television launched. We're going to play an interview with the star of that program coming up from Charlie Brennan, probably about 20 years ago. It's Overnight America, KMOX. Welcome back to Overnight America. You know, we could be playing a different theme song right about now. Bum, bum. So pleasant, isn't it? This would be a fun song to learn on piano, wouldn't it? Dun, 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 dun. Brings you back, doesn't it? Just so pleasant. Did you know on this date, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood debuted? Season one.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood.
A beautiful day for a neighbor.
Would you be mine? Could you be mine?
You know, it debuted on the National Educational Television Network, the NET, and then PBS picked it up starting season four. So February 19th, 1968, first aired.
I have always wanted to have a neighbor.
Just like you.
I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you. So let's make the most of this beautiful day.
Oh, what a great song, too. Opening theme song. He wrote all these. He wrote the sheet music for it. I don't know how many songs he wrote over the course of the show. It was a lot. But from the KMOX archives, you're going to love this. I was going through it, and I found an interview with Charlie Brennan and Mr. Rogers. And I thought, wow, this will be fun. How about we play that as part of Overnight America? I messaged Charlie and I said, hey, do you mind if we replay it? And he said, sure, go for it. Let's go back in time.
Starting with that fella who has made quite a career on PBS, the man with the cardigan sweater, I think you know him.
Gives a hand up.
Fred Rogers, who has been the host of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the longest-running program on PBS since the early 1960s. Currently, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood is seen on more than 300 television stations in the United States and Canada. In fact, his career started in Canada. It runs in St. Louis on Channel 9, 7:30 and 10:05 every weekday morning. Seen in more than 8 million households every week. The winner of almost every broadcasting award ever given, including the industry's top honor, the Peabody. His sweater is in the Smithsonian Institution about 10 or 15 feet away from Archie Bunker's chair. He's a Presbyterian minister. I stopped counting his honorary degrees after 25. He may have reached the 30 mark at this point. And it's hard to believe, Fred Rogers, that your show was actually canceled once in 1967.
I can hardly remember that, but now that you bring it up, one of the people said, since you're not a director, I don't think we can afford to keep you on staff. You're just a producer. And somebody came to my rescue and said, don't you realize this program has a chance to grow and make a difference in this country? And they reconsidered, and here we are.
How would you like to be the guy, though, who canceled Mr. Rogers? What a legacy, huh?
Well, he's in heaven at the moment. I heard that he had died a couple years ago, and I know that he came around afterwards and felt that it wasn't the best decision to make, and so he supported us after that.
He joined the millions of others who have enjoyed you on television, have enjoyed your more than 20 books, and you're here today talking about your latest book, which is You Are Special, Words of Wisdom from America's Most Beloved Neighbor. That's kind of neat. You're not really big into merchandising, although you do sell some books and tapes.
Well, that's right. Charlie, this book took 40 years to write because it's just a compilation of lots of 3 and 4 lines of things that I have said all through the years. And it's really an adult book. It's a book for people who have grown up with the neighborhood. And my wife, for instance, keeps it at the table where she sits and reads, and she picks it up to read for 5 minutes, and she says she'll sometimes read it for half an hour or an hour. Because could I read you a couple lines from it?
We'd be very happy to have something from You Are Special, Words of Wisdom from America's Most Beloved Neighbor. Sure, please.
On page 8, deep within us, no matter who we are, there lives a feeling of wanting to be lovable, of wanting to be the kind of person that others like to be with. And then there's quite a bit of space. And I always tell people, you know, it's the spaces between these quotations that are the most important, because that's what's to encourage you to think about what's just been said. The world needs a sense of worth, and it will achieve it only by its people feeling that they are worthwhile.
I want to ask you something, if I might interrupt you.
Please.
Not to step on the space here, but I know your background is, it's rich with experience and education. I know that you're a Presbyterian minister. You have studied psychology, but it seems to me a lot of the words, the messages from You Are Special come from those early experiences that you had maybe with your mother or your grandfather or those who shared your life when you were a kid.
Absolutely. Do you know what it's like to grow up with parents and grandparents yourself?
I sure do.
Well, you know what a difference that has made in your becoming. And like many other values that our children get from us, things like compassion are much more likely to be caught than taught. We do not teach people such things as love and respect. We give it to them, they incorporate it, and in turn give it back to others.
There's a story that your grandfather used to, when you were 8 years old, let you play on a stone wall that your parents were always afraid that you'd climb.
Yes, they always thought I'd fall and break something. And my grandfather used to say, let the kid walk on the wall. He's got to learn to do things for himself. And that was such an important thing for me, to have somebody who trusted my individuation. In fact, I'm sitting in my office here in Pittsburgh, and there's a plaque that somebody gave me a couple months ago, and it says, Freddie, I like you just the way you are. And underneath it says, Fred Brooks McFeely. And that was my grandfather's name. Now, there's something that he gave to me that I've been able to pass on to a lot of children. I like you just the way you are.
Did he actually say that to you? Did he make that plaque for you?
Yeah. No, he didn't make the plaque. A friend of mine had it made for me and just gave it to me a couple months ago. My grandfather's been in heaven for years and years, since 1952. But he said, Freddie, I like you just the way you are. And he played the violin. You know, he's an amateur violinist. And I'll never forget being able to accompany him once I learned to play the piano. He and I played that song, Play, Gypsy, Dance, Gypsy, Play While You May. Isn't it wonderful? I mean, here I am a grandfather now, and last night, I was with our 2-year-old grandson. He and I were sitting on the piano bench together. Talk about continuity.
You know, that is the cycle or the circle of life, isn't it?
Exactly. And I am very glad to have been able to put my foot in that cycle and my teacher, my beloved Margaret McFarland, who was our psychological consultant for the program for years and years, used to say, we put our foot in the stream of life, and then we take it out. But the stream goes on.
She also said of you that you are one of those rare individuals who has not shed your childhood experiences, that you remember your childhood where a lot of people pretty much put that behind. Is that true?
Oh, I don't remember everything about my childhood, but I think that the child in me is not gone. And I know that I'm very comfortable when I'm in the presence of young children. I think of Emily Jacobson, who was the poetry lady on our program for many years, and there was this wonderful poem that she used to tell. In fact, she would often say it to Daniel Tiger, because he would say to it, Miss Emily, would you please say that one about the best of whatever you are? And then Miss Emily would say, well, sure. And she would say, if you can't be a pine on the top of a hill, be a scrub in the valley, but be the best little scrub by the side of the rill. Be a bush if you can't be a tree. If you can't be a highway, then just be a trail. If you can't be a sun, be a star. It isn't by size that you win or you fail. Be the best of whatever you are.
You know, I get a kick because every time I open up a magazine, there's another article on the new awakening to self-esteem, how to increase your self-esteem, how to increase your youngster self-esteem. And in fact, you have been doing that since day one of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Well, the most important thing we can do is to help people feel that they have value, at least help them look for what is valuable within them. Don't you find that in your life, that if there's somebody who is around who says, don't you remember when you did such and such? And that helps you to feel that you can do more.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. What might be unique is that in Saturday morning television, or in a lot of television, especially that directed toward youngsters, the little boys and girls are treated like consumers, and Mr. Rogers treats them like human beings. You are unique in that respect. Do you agree?
It's very important, Charlie, to allow people to realize that they can make something of their environment rather than having to go out and buy it. So from the first that we've ever been on television, I've tried to encourage children to make their own toys, to look at something and think, hey, what could that be if I wrapped my imagination around it?
That's Fred Rogers. His latest book is You Are Special, and it's sold wherever great books are available.
That was a classic from the KMOX archive. I had to look that up. Originally published September of 1994. So I'm going to guess that interview was close to September of 1994. What a cool flashback. On this date, the very first episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood aired February 19th, 1968. Really cool. This is Overnight America, KMOX. Oh, getting some text messages in. Still some driving conditions. Let's see. 40 westbound to Big Bend was fine if you've ever driven on wet road. Okay, that's a good tip. Thank you to whoever put that one in. I think I know who that was. I know who that was now. Aw. He remembered. Oh, here's one from Iowa. How about this text message? It says, in Iowa, we got 8 inches of snow this past Sunday. Tonight, another 8 to 10 inches. Back in 73 and 93 in Alton, Illinois, in St. Louis, had a really bad ice storm. Power went out, and everyone is upset that you're getting worked up with a light icing. Ice is bad no matter how much every it is. Okay, I think the autocorrect on the text messaging might be a little bit weird there. But thank you for those tips. if you're still driving around the St. Louis region, and I think the roads, I mean, they've been working on them. I know that. It was bad right when we started the show at 11. It was not an easy thing. In fact, we had updates that they were out there working and treating, but, you know, the people that called in were, not that I've seen. They were leaving the Blues game, and they were not having the exact same experience. Before we go to news here, how about this one? There's a story out of Las Vegas. A hawk swooped in? What does that mean, a hawk swooped in and almost took a poor little puppy?
When Cecilia Sellis let Lulu out, she shut the door and looked away.
Lulu, there's only one type of dog you can name Lulu, which is any dog that weighs under 4 pounds.
Little did she know, something else was watching.
It waits a little and then it swoops on her.
That it is a red-tailed hawk.
Ooh.
You can see it in this video dive towards the toy Yorkie.
It happens so fast. Like, we just let them out and then the bird swoops in,
whoa,
drags her, and it's like choking her. It stood on her.
The hawk.
Whoa, and it's caught on camera. What, do you get like a BB gun for that? What's the best way to take care of a hawk that's gonna try to menace your family pet?
Fighting with its potential prey before dragging the puppy and hovering over her.
And I was yelling at it. I was like, get off my dog, get off my dog.
Sellis.
I know. Birds listen, don't they? Hey, dog, don't worry. I yelled at the bird. You'll be fine.
It ran out in a panic, first trying to shoo the bird away.
I was screaming at it the whole time, like, get off, and it wasn't fazed by me. It was just like staring at me in the eyes.
So then Sellis grabbed a pillow.
That's the first thing I saw that wouldn't hurt her or the bird.
And she hit the hawk.
No, I wouldn't be worried about hurting that bird. Of course I wouldn't want to hurt my dog. Could you go bare knuckle fighting with a hawk that's attached to a dog? Now, even though this is a tiny dog, the hawk is struggling to fly away with this, you know, 2-3 pound dog or whatever it is. It's not going to be able to just easily fly out like it's a mouse or anything like that. So this hawk is kind of like grappling with it on the ground, and this poor dog's just trying to escape. Could you just go bear punch a hawk in the head and get this thing to let go?
Not just once or twice.
It took 3-4 shots to get it off.
The bird finally flying away, but it didn't go very far. The family was able to snap these pictures of the hawk.
Oh.
They believe it's someone's pet.
We're still scared because it's still around here.
As for
someone's pet, first sighting of that hawk, you better believe you're shooting that thing, right? Maybe an air pellet? You know, something that, you know, you don't want to put a, you know, something dangerous, like a shotgun or something crazy like that.
For little Lulu, she's doing better. The hawk clawed her in the neck. Lulu and her sister Heidi weigh just 2 pounds each. So Sellis and her family say from now on, they'll be watching their pups like a hawk.
Oh, I get that pun, like a hawk, huh? All right, Overnight America will continue. One more hour. Hey, something that surprised some people about the Trump administration. We're going to talk about that in Jussie Smollett's Scenes Cut Out of Empire. What's the update there? This is Overnight America. KMOX.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.